This is the Logic Consortium. Two Wednesdays a month, we're here. I am one of your hosts, Jacob Briskovich, and today we're lucky enough to have in the studio again, Dr. Alexandra Falindra.
Good morning, Jake.
Good morning. Good morning. And assistant professor of political science at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And we were lucky enough to have her in the studio on July 25th. Two Wednesdays ago, where we talked about a number of things on immigration. Let me just be clear, we're taking all calls at 773-508-WLUW. And we're going to be talking about immigration again, and just immigration policy, the politics, local laws, and we're going to be reviewing a bunch of the points we made last week. And we're also hoping to have immigration attorney Daniel Tolman in the studio. He just called me. He is in court right now, and he's on his way. So We're excited for that, too. So, Dr. Falindra, first of all, thank you so much for joining us again.
Oh, sure.
And last week, as you know, we covered about three main points. First, we covered your article entitled The Myth of Self-Deportation, where we talked about these local immigration laws.
Yes, exactly. A lot of the enforcement laws that have passed in states like Arizona and Alabama and Georgia, even Indiana has here in the neighborhood quite stringent enforcement laws, rely on an understanding of human behavior that is very simplistic. They basically contend that if you put a lot of pressure on people and increase the probability that they will be caught and apprehended and end up in detention or in jail, that they will actually voluntarily pick up and leave. That's the idea that actually Mitt Romney, the presumptive candidate for the Republican Party for the president, floated during the debates last semester, that basically rational immigrants will just self-deport because all these laws put a lot of pressure on them.
So not only are these local laws relying on some flawed logic, because as you do find in your paper, these people who come to the country who are subjected to these laws do not, in fact, self-deport.
That is absolutely right. We know empirically, and there's a number of studies already showing that most people just will stay put. We have a history of immigration here for many decades of undocumented immigrants, progressively more restrictive laws, and yet undocumented immigration continues to be a phenomenon that stays with us. Well, why is that? The reason is that people do not behave in accordance with a very simplistic logic that is part of this model.
What they do is, this logic doesn't take into account, as we mentioned last week, everything that the immigrants have invested, not only in getting here to the United States, oftentimes paying a lot of money to cross the border at risk of life and limb a lot of the time, but also all the investments that people have made while they're here. The statistics that you mentioned last week about up to 35% of undocumented persons own homes and own real estate in this country. So it's not going to be that easy just to scare people off with these laws. And one of the big parts that we haven't even mentioned that we talked a lot about last week is a lot of these laws have been deemed by the United States Supreme Court to be unconstitutional.
Right, exactly, because they restrict a number of basic liberties of individual persons. And the Supreme Court has seen that as a very problematic aspect of these laws. And you're absolutely right, Jake. There is an issue with the amount of investment and what these people have put in. In the language of economics, it's called sunk costs. And we know about that, all right? Right? It is all the money, all the effort, emotional and social and everything else that you have put into your life. You have essentially what we call roots. You have set roots in a community. You have set roots in an area. And after 5, 10, 20 years that you have been there and you have a bank account and a car and a house and children who go to school and your friends and neighbors and your church and everything else, just because the law changes and the police now have more latitude to check your papers and scare you, that doesn't mean you're going to pick up and leave. You're just going to go further out in the shadows. People literally hide behind bushes because they're so afraid. But hiding behind bushes is not the same thing as picking up my bags and going home. They're still here. They're just even further in the shadows and more likely to be abused, more likely to be vulnerable, more likely to face things that a democratic society should not tolerate.
Asking you to guess right now for a minute, do you think, taking into consideration this recent Supreme Court decision, there will be even still laws passed, local and municipal laws saying that immigrants cannot do such and such, they cannot work with papers, things that the United States Supreme Court seems to have already spoken on and said that are not constitutional?
I think so, Dan. I think that the states are actually trying to send a signal to the federal government to provide a solution to the problem that is more national and holistic. And as long as the federal government, because of partisan issues, does not act on it, I think that there is incentive at the state level to pursue all avenues that have not been closed by the Supreme Court, or to be even more inventive, whether it is through more stringent employment verification things, which the court said that they have more latitude with penalizing employers, with other things within the employment sphere. But even there, there's a lot of limitations because, yes, big corporations, big employers can check for people's papers and can figure out whether they have a valid Social Security number. But private individuals, the person who hires somebody to look after her kids or the person who hires somebody to clean up the pool, are they going to have to go through Social Security Administration records to find out if that person is here with an employment authorization, if they have the right to work? They're looking for somebody locally to do some basic housework. And that private economy is close to impossible to regulate. What are you going to do? Go from house to house and check every nanny and every gardener and every assistant in a home to see if they have papers? And are you going to put the onus on me as an individual to check the papers of everybody who comes into my home, to clean, to help, to do things like that?
Let me just be clear. This is the Logic Consortium. Today we're having in the studio Professor Alexandra Falindra, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and we're taking all calls. We'll be talking immigration for the next at least 20-some-odd minutes, if not 30, at 773-508-WLUW. And we're kind of reviewing the conversation that we had a couple of weeks ago, and we're talking about the state and local immigration laws that were passed under this assumption that if they kind of tighten the strings on immigrants, they're going to leave. But this has been found not to be the case. People are not leaving, yet they're kind of dipping deeper into the shadows. And we were talking about this in the context of the June 25th, 2012 United States versus Arizona Supreme Court decision that basically talked, while it did say a lot of the laws that state and localities have passed are unconstitutional, it did leave the door open a little bit for state and local governments to pass laws. As you kind of just mentioned, they gave them some latitude on employment, and they also said the big thing was this show me your papers law is not on its face unconstitutional, meaning that as long as the detention is actually not prolonged by the state or local official asking for the person's papers, it could be constitutional. So on a jaywalking case, I think they gave two examples to the court. They said a jaywalking case, if it takes 20 minutes to ask for the person's papers, that is a prolonged detention because a jaywalking ticket should not take more than a few minutes. But on a DUI case, it is because the detention will take about 30 minutes or so or longer, it might not be unconstitutional to ask for the person's papers. So We'll see, I guess, what happens in the wake of this decision, but state and local laws. But as you mentioned, because a lot of the states are very upset for reasons we're going to get to, whether they're real or mythical, they are, in fact, upset people for one reason or another, and they're going to continue to pass laws until they think that there's this comprehensive immigration reform solution. But that does bring me to the second issue that we talked about last week, which is, is immigration a problem, a drain on the economy, a drain on social services? And last week we tried to debunk a lot of the myths out there of people who are anti-immigration. They talk about a drain on social services, but, I mean, we got to really investigate that claim much deeper. Which social services are they talking about? Because, as we mentioned last week, it is impossible to avoid many of the taxes that are out there. Everybody, no matter if they're renting or owning, is paying property tax.
Correct.
And property tax is the lion's share of localities, of education, local education, and also local hospitals and things like that. So nobody's avoiding that tax.
Absolutely true. You're right, Jake. Basically, when you are a renter or a homeowner, you pay implicitly or explicitly, directly or indirectly, you pay taxes. You pay property taxes. Your rent goes to your landlord, who pays property taxes. So your rent reflects the property taxes on the home. And if you own the home, then you pay the government property taxes. So the argument that immigrants overburden our educational systems because they don't contribute to the system while their kids go to school is absolutely false, because they do contribute, they do pay taxes, they do pay property taxes, they do pay sales taxes, and the truth is that the vast majority of them also pay income tax, personal income tax, especially federal income tax, and they because they use improper social security numbers, they cannot claim it back, they cannot get refunds. The money goes to Social Security, and actually Social Security Administration is quite happy about that money, because these are people who are paying into the system for the rest of us, and they will never see the benefits of that. They will never have access to Social Security. So people may have been paying Social Security for 5, 10 years, decades, and never see a penny of that money, which comes out of their own checks. And instead, that money goes to the rest of us when we get Social Security benefits when we're over 65.
Let me remind everybody, this is WLUW-FM, Chicago Sound Alliance, broadcasting live from the campus of Loyola. And today we're here live in the studio with Dr. Alexandra Falindra, assistant professor of political science at the University of Illinois Chicago. And we're taking all calls. We're talking about immigration today at 773-508-WLUW. And we'd like to answer any of your questions or rebut or talk about any arguments that we've brought up and explain further. And we'd love to hear from you, so don't hesitate. We'd love to get your call. And so we're basically talking about that this myth that people are a drain, immigrants are a drain on social services, doesn't take into account at all the taxes that people are paying, the taxes that are unavoidable, and many of the times the taxes that they'll never see a return on. As you mentioned, fake Social Security numbers are ever-present, and people will never see an earned income tax credit on that, a tax refund, a tax, other types of tax exemptions. And also, most people are paying payroll taxes into Social Security that will never reap the benefits of retirement. So, and then also unavoidable local property taxes and sales taxes. Those nobody can hide from.
And also, it is important to note what's happening next week, in fact, and the potential in immigrants that, even undocumented immigrants that the United States government, that the president has recognized through the deferment action that is taking place as of August 15. Essentially, the president passed an executive order saying a change in policy that children, undocumented children of immigrants who have graduated from high school and are going on to college and are getting educated and are making a contribution and have a great potential to make a contribution to American society because they're educated here, because they speak English, because they share American values and the American dream, should have a chance to stay here legally and get a job and be able to at least for temporarily, because through presidential action, you can't change immigration policy. He's giving them just a reprieve for a few years, hoping that a more permanent solution is going to happen. And this is a huge change of policy, even though it is a temporary solution, that's taking place on the 15th, and a lot of people are really excited about it.
So we're obviously talking about this idea of the Dream Act and this presidential order that came down around on or about June 15th that basically said that people who came to the United States under the age of 16 have been here for at least 5 years, are currently under the age of 31, and then are currently studying, have graduated high school, some type of U.S. service, and don't have significant misdemeanors or felonies, and pay the fee, can apply for this two-year deferred action status, where they can apply for employment authorization. And I know the application's coming out the 15th, and everybody's very excited about it, but it is only a temporary reprieve, and who knows what's going to happen. People say that, oh, it can be renewed after 2 years, but what we don't know who's going to be the next president, and he could easily, another president could undo this and could stop somebody's deferred action status right in their tracks potentially. And one also interesting thing that they announced was no information will be shared with Customs and Border Patrol or Immigration and Customs Enforcement, because people are going to have to list the members of their household and their status. And a lot of the people who are applying have older siblings who are out of status, have parents that are out of status. So it'd be interesting to see what happens. But it is kind of a half step. Everybody's talking about it, and a lot of people are happy, but it's still really not advancing the ball that far, although it's great for a ton of people, no doubt about that.
Absolutely. It is a really great development. Limited as it is very, very positive news, and it's very positive news for the best and the youngest and the really worthy cases of the kids, of the next generation, of the people who are going to help us save Social Security. Because let's face it, this country is getting older.
Right.
A lot of Americans are not having three and four kids that is required in order to replenish the population. The number of baby boomers who are coming into retirement is enormous. It's several million. And the number of workers who are in the economy who have to pay for those benefits and Social Security is not equally as much. You need to have a certain number of workers per retiree in order to be able to make the calculation, to be able to support the system. When the Social Security system was set up during the Depression, you had 10 workers for one retired person. Today we're in a situation where we're looking at 4 workers per retired person. That's a big deal. That means that the taxes out of 4 people rather than 10 have to support the older people. So it is in the benefit of anybody who is approaching 65 to be in support of immigration reform and a more inclusive immigration policy, because we need more young people who are going to be the workers of the future. Otherwise, you will have to cut benefits to retirees or raise taxes to these 4 people who are supporting each retiree to a point that is unsustainable. That's the conversation right now. And one of the reasons that the U.S. is not in the same boat as Europe. Europe is in a really bad situation when it comes to their retirement age, because their growth rate in terms of their population is zero and below zero. Europe is essentially dying as a continent from a population standpoint. And it is important to note that at least in the U.S., there's a growth rate. There are kids being born at a much higher rate, and that is because immigrants are coming in, and they have more kids. Immigrants in general have more kids than Americans do, and that helps us sustain the population. Those are the doctors and the lawyers and the engineers of the future that we will need when we're retired to take care of our roads and hospitals and everything we need. Where are they going to come from if not from immigrants?
Let me remind everybody, this is the Logic Consortium, and today we're live in the studio on the broadcasting from the campus of Loyola, and we're taking all calls, 773-508-WLUW, and we have Dr. Alexandra Falindra in the studio, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And we were just kind of talking about this recent dream, quasi-dream act that will be put in place August 15th. In a couple of days, they're going to come out with the application. I believe it's about $460 total with the employment authorization. We'll give somebody two-year deferred action status. And we were just talking about it in the context of Social Security, and I did want to get to the Social Security issue because you brought up something that I find very interesting, which is this idea that Social Security is going bankrupt. And now you mentioned there are only four workers for every retiree. When Social Security was passed many years ago, there were 10 workers for every retiree. So is this Social Security system, unless there's some new reform where you increase the Social Security taxes on the worker or limit the benefits to the retiree, will the Social Security system go bankrupt, or is that just talk from people?
For now, Social Security is solvent for a few decades. So for most of the baby boomers, they should be able to get benefits at their current state or levels for a couple of decades. But given that people live longer, when Social Security passed in the 1930s, the average age to which people lived was early 60s. Today, it's mid-70s plus. You know, women live to their 80s on average. So you're now looking at spending, the government, when they set up Social Security, were thinking that they're paying people on average until the age of, late 60s. So when you start getting money out at 65, if you lived another 3 or 4 years, that's all the benefits that the government was responsible for. Now they have to pay 10, 20, 30 years of benefits. It's not the same calculation anymore. On top of that, with the birth rates dropping and not enough new workers getting into the economy, there's the problem of where you're going to get this money to pay for the benefits for these people who are out there and live so much longer. And it's a great thing that people live long, but we need to find ways for a sustainable system. And increasing the working age population of the country and having a plan on how to maintain the workforce and expand the workforce is among the things that we need to do. It might require increases in taxes. It may require, already we're talking about changes in the age of retirement from 65 to 67, maybe to 70. There are very many issues with that because as you get older, people may not be able to work anymore. A person who's 65 may have all kinds of health issues, difficulties. It may not be feasible for a lot of people to keep working past the age of 65. So there are all these things that need to be taken into account of. But essentially, unless serious solutions are found, we are looking at possible cuts to Social Security and increase in Social Security taxes in order to even maintain the current level of benefits. And for my generation, the younger generation, if things are not reformed in a way that includes an expansion of the workforce, we won't see a Social Security. You and I ain't getting any Social Security. Mm-hmm. We're paying into it, but it's very likely we may not see it.
But it will be this. But it will be solvent for the next couple of decades, and hopefully we can do a tweak and
we have time.
We can confront the problems that higher life expectancy has brought to the new issues. This brings up such interesting issues about the role of government and increased taxes and people that are against things and the social safety net. But I did want to talk about the third main issue that we talked about last week. The first was the state and local immigration laws and this myth that people were going to deport on their own if laws were more stringent. The second is this idea that immigrants are a drain on the economy. We really tried to debunk many of those myths and arguments. And this third is the history of immigration that we talked about last week. How the current Latino – let me just first say, this is the Logic Consortium. We're on broadcasting live from the campus of Loyola, and we're taking all calls. We haven't had a call yet. We'd love one. 773-508-WLUW. And we have Dr. Alexandra Fillinger in the studio. We're talking about immigration law, history, politics, policy. And we were just talking about Social Security, which was tied into this idea that if you get more people paying into the system, maybe it will be more solvent. So there should be some type of comprehensive immigration reform that this DREAM Act is taking a small step toward. This DREAM Act that's coming out August 15th. But we're talking about the history of immigration laws. And you mentioned last week something that was really interesting we closed off with was how the Latino population of today are yesterday's Irish immigrants, Italian immigrants, and there were signs, discrimination, persecution toward Irish and Italian immigrants at the turn of last century. So can we talk about this a little bit? Do we have a call?
Hello?
Hello, you're on live. How are you today?
Good, good. I'm listening to your show. It's very interesting, but I was wondering about something I heard, and that is that after this restrictive laws on immigrants were passed in Alabama not too long ago, that farmers and other people were complaining because typically the immigrants and usually the undocumented immigrants are the ones that work in the fields. It's one of those jobs that Americans often don't want to do. And I had heard that since these laws were passed in Alabama, that the illegal immigrants, who are also the farm workers, mysteriously disappeared, and the farmers were quite concerned about this. Has that situation changed at all?
The reports that are coming out of Alabama, and they're not systematic, they're mostly out of journalistic accounts, say that initially people got scared and left the state, but as soon as sort of they got an understanding of what's going on and things normalized, a lot of families went back. There is still a shortage of workers in the area. From what I've seen, farmers are extremely concerned, especially when there was a program, the local Chamber of Commerce, I think it was, local business organizations got together and organized a program to advertise positions in agriculture and essentially, they ended up with a very small number of people, like 30 people who actually, American citizens, who actually were willing to do the work. And of those, very, very few actually showed up the next day because it's backbreaking work. It's very, very difficult. I have great respect for people who work in agriculture because it's a very heavy-duty kind of work.
Thank you so much, caller. The caller was – we really appreciate your call. The caller was bringing up these reports that were reporting all over after Alabama and other states passed these laws. There were these reports that the fruit was rotting on the vine. These came out all over. That in Alabama and other states, there weren't enough immigrant workers. They became scared initially, and they left their position in the field. And And then the farmers were having a tough time gathering enough workers to take people off. And you were talking about how there weren't enough American workers who were willing to fulfill these jobs. That gets to another issue that we really didn't discuss. There are kind of two main issues when you talk about the economy. We discussed this last week, and I really thank the caller for bringing this up. We discussed last week how not only some of the myths that immigrants are a drain on the economy, but this idea, do they take American jobs, and do they take American employment? And last week we kind of talked about how all the immigrant work in the workforce is really kind of a stimulus package, that there can be so many other hands on deck. They can do so many other things that some American workers don't really want to do. It's this idea, are the jobs complementary or are they competitive? And Dr. Falinger, can you talk about that a little bit, getting to the ideas that the caller talked about? Thank you so much, and we're taking all other calls, 773-508-WLUW.
Absolutely, Jake. There is this sense in the public discourse and in the media that immigrants take jobs from Americans, but immigrants come in with very, very different skills from, for the most part, skills that Americans, for better or worse, have left behind. They have to do with manual work. They have to do with agriculture, expertise in agriculture. And very few people in the United States who are citizens, for better or worse, are interested in those fields and want to do that kind of work. It pays very little. It is very, very hard. It is very far from cities, and most people in the U.S. live in cities. And it's seasonal. I want my kids to have full year employment, not to go from farm to farm every month or every couple of months following the season. So our aspirations make us look for different kinds of jobs for us and our kids. We want more stability. We want better paying jobs. And these jobs are not filled by Americans. And these efforts that have been made, and they have been systematic in many of the agricultural states, where they blanket the area with advertisement, they offer higher wages, they do a number of things, and still they're not able to recruit people because they don't have the strength. They don't have what it takes in many ways. It requires training to be a manual worker in some ways.
And they don't want to
train.
And
they don't want to train. No.
Right. As you're saying, it's grueling work. They're looking for other jobs, and they're saying other people can do this. So that's very interesting. We'll take all other calls. And I'm glad the caller brought that up about the issue of employment. And again, 773-508-WLUW. We're going to be on the air for another few minutes. I did want to get to the last. Daniel Tolman is not going to come. I just did get his text message, immigration attorney. Maybe we'll have him on the 22nd. I don't know. But I wanted to get to this last issue that we talked about last week, which I kind of briefly mentioned, which is that the Latino population of today is yesterday's Irish and Italian immigrant population, that are receiving some type of negative stigma for whatever silly reason, as we've tried to debunk today. Although, obviously, the debate will not be settled from this conversation that we're having now, but we're trying to just exhaust flesh out these arguments, and we're trying to see what are the real arguments against immigration, because I don't see them, but there is this whole other dynamic of safety and enforcement, although nobody who committed the 9/11 attacks came over the border from the South, but that's another issue for another day. But can we talk about, briefly, kind of wrapping things up, this issue of the history and looking at it through a historical context?
Absolutely. The United States has a long history of immigration and a very long history of anti-immigrant responses. People have always had concerns about the different people, the new people who are coming in. In the 1850s, it was the Catholics. Irish started coming in, and that caused great alarm for the English and other sort of Protestant Americans who were here and who were concerned about the Pope. They thought that anybody who believed in the Pope could not possibly believe in democracy and was radical and was going to be subversive and hurt the government of the United States. The anti-Irish climate was horrendous. Irish people were discriminated in employment. They were beaten up. Irish monasteries were burned. It was an incredible hysteria in the 1850s. Then in the early 20th century, the late 19th century, early 20th century, when Southern Europeans started coming in, it was the Italians, it was the Greeks. They don't speak our language. They don't understand our culture. They will never learn. They don't want to learn. Does that sound familiar to you?
Mm-hmm.
There is a great sign that I remember seeing a picture of from the early part of the 20th century. It's from a New York City restaurant, and it says, "Good American food. No rats, no Greeks."
Huh. Wow. All right. So thank you for that great historical rendition of the history of immigration, and it kind of makes sense what's happening. People are tribalistic in their tendencies at the core, and that is only worked through once people become familiar with others, and that's why it's so easy for countries like Sweden to say, oh, we pay high taxes and no crime rate and things like that. Because people, once people come and mix together, although great things can happen, there is frictions at the beginning and that hopefully people can work through once they become accustomed to their surroundings.
It's true. People integrate. Immigrants are actually the best that other countries have to offer. It takes a lot to leave your home behind and take the risks to move to a different country. So the immigrants are actually quite exceptional, and they add to the American exceptionalism because they bring the best, the most hardworking people here. And they're determined. They come here because they buy into the idea of the American dream, and the vast, vast majority of them are determined to succeed on American terms, and they do everything that they can to integrate. Their kids, for the vast majority, like 98% of immigrant kids, are primarily English speaking. For the first generation, it's harder because when you come here as an adult, it takes time to learn a foreign language, and if you're working 14-hour shifts, where are you gonna go learn? So even though the first generation has the handicap of not speaking the language, they make darn sure that their kids speak English because they recognize the advantages. And they want their kids to be American. And the vast majority of the kids are primarily American English speakers, and they completely identify as Americans. You cannot tell them apart in terms of the way they're thinking and who they are.
Well, Dr. Felindra, thank you so much for joining us again in the studio. I think we're going to wrap it up here. And this is the Logic Consortium, broadcasting live from the campus of Loyola, and we'll be back with you in 2 weeks. Have a great day, everybody.